saints.
We'll touch that dream.
We'll touch that dream. Come slow and
not at all. You're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, and this is Earth Boots, Radio Reverb's adventure travel show. And we're broadcasting from my kitchen today, so there might be a few background noises, but I'm sure you'll enjoy it. With me today I have Paradox, a performance poet and friend of some years, and we're getting ready to head off to Butterfield, one of our favourite festivals, week after next. So we thought we'd grab this moment to do some stuff, to talk about Chris's travel and his emotional journey over these previous years. I first met I guess a raving, ranting young man who had loads to talk about, and still does, but somehow seems to have kind of grabbed a little of maturity, perhaps. Anyway, welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Ken. Good to be here.
Good to have you too. So for anybody that hasn't seen you, Chris is Paradox is his performance name, is a performance poet, and he's talking about life stuff, the paradoxes of life,
and the human experience.
And the human.
I don't think there's anybody that hasn't seen me, but I understand you have to do that just as a technicality.
Especially as you can now move to Brighton.
That's right.
Indeed. Okay, but for those who have seen you. Where did all this start? Where did Mr. Paradox start?
Well, Paradox was born in a park. And for anyone that's lived in London, in my opinion, London's most beautiful park, Battersea Park, by the river. And I ended up there after leaving my job working for an advertising agency. I was, at the time, managing director of a media buying company within the agency. Mm. So I spent many years in the business world. I was a full-on rat racer, did all the things that people in advertising tend to do, so work hard, play hard, that whole thing, drive fast cars. And I remember one day my board of directors, when they actually made me a director of the company, it was, you know, it was a dream come true. That's what I'd been working towards, to be one of the one of the board. And they actually took me out, took me to dinner at this amazing restaurant in Holland Park. And I remember we left the office and got in a cab. And the minute we got in the cab, these people that I'd been working with for the previous 5 years started talking about other staff members in a way I'd never heard them talk before. And, you know, literally I was in the inner circle, and all of a sudden I could see that their view of the staff was really very much as commodities. Mm. And that was a bit of a shock. But I kind of bit my tongue and said, well, you know, I don't know this world, so I'll just, you know, I won't rock the boat. I'll just see how it goes. And we got to the restaurant, and we're all sitting around the table, and there's about 12 directors, all middle-aged men. And I think we'd eaten, and in my mind I had a question that I was desperate to ask them, because I'd always looked up to them as these successful men. And I wanted to ask them, you know, what are we here for? What's the meaning of life? What do you guys think about it? And when the dinner finished and we had a bit of a toast, I then kind of went around the table asking them. And to a man, their answers were, you know, the human race is a virus and we're here and it's all random luck and chance and survival of the fittest and the kill and dog. And honestly, it just, it shattered my naive illusions that they were doing what they were doing for the, for any reason other than a sort of neo-Darwinian feeling that if we don't kill and survive, somebody else will.
Yeah.
And that really disillusioned me, basically. I thought, well, I can't work for these men, and I lost my whole sort of feeling towards the industry. At the same time, I'd also just recently got married. I'd also started to read some spiritual literature.
Right.
I mean, very very cliched, but The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, Celestine Prophecy, and Conversations with God.
Yeah,
they all had a powerful effect on me, and I kind of had, I suppose, what you'd call it, a sort of a social conscience was born in me for the first time, and some form of spiritual consciousness. And I started to care about the planet, and started to care about other people, and started to care about what my life meant. And I realized that there was no real fulfillment in that career path that I'd followed, which was fair enough, but it just, something just changed in me. I said, well, I'm never going to find meaning here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm a man of extremes, and I started to work for Friends of the Earth, work for them for 6 months, door-to-door fundraising.
Right.
That was quite funny because I had an Alfa Romeo at the time, and I had it for 3 months when my company made me redundant. Yeah. And then I went straight to work, commission-only, door-knocking for Friends of the Earth, driving around in an Alfa Romeo, which I thought was quite paradoxical.
Yeah.
And I left them because I then started to research the financial system and the money supply, which we'll talk about later. And that disillusioned me even further when I saw the sort of corruption at the heart of society. And I felt so disillusioned that I said, I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what my place in the world is. I'm going to go and live in Battersea Park, sell the big issue, become a bum until God, spirit, the universe, life shows me what the hell I'm supposed to do.
And did it?
And yeah, after 3 months of living in under a tree in a park, selling the big issue, feeling more kind of natural than I'd ever felt before. It was a strange thing. Becoming a nobody was exactly what I needed.
Sure.
And 3 months in, poetry started to pour out. I'd never really written a poem in my life before.
Right.
And this character, this alter ego, Paradox, emerged. It's always been one of my favourite concepts. And, it's a great stage name.
Yeah.
And I started stopping people on the streets and saying, would you like a poem? And then somebody said, why don't you do an open mic? And I went and did an open mic. Someone spotted me and just carried on from there.
Right. Cool. And so where did this take you, you know, after you've kind of thrown off your green shoes, where did you go from there?
Well, I suppose they always say it's not what you know, it's who you know. And from performing at various venues, I then met some of my closest friends still to this day. This was 8 years ago.
Right.
And I met a group of people who were running a sort of legal squat called the 491 Gallery.
Okay.
In Leytonstone.
Right.
And they were all artists and activists and anarchists. And I moved into that. That was a squat with the landlord's permission where they were paying a peppercorn rent.
Sure.
And they used the space for, as a community space, workshops, parties, all sorts of events.
Yeah.
And they literally gutted it. It was full of syringes and crap when they got there.
Yeah.
And they'd really done it up and made, you know, they'd made it valuable again for the landlord. So they had a really good arrangement.
Yeah.
And there's lots of that going on now, particularly in Liverpool.
Right.
We're run down inner city warehouses, properties. Artists will move in because they can't afford rental space in big cities. And they'll say to the landlord, look, we'll make the place look beautiful. We'll look after it. We'll make sure you don't have to hire a security firm. We'll stop drug addicts coming in here. You know, we'll do it in a partnership.
Right.
And that, the 491 Gallery was one of the first of those.
Okay.
And just living with those guys, it was an education. You know, I didn't really, as I say, didn't have much practical experience of activism, of any kind of social conscience movement. So all of my stuff was researched. I was a media researcher. So when I researched the money system, that was my area of, let's say, expertise.
Yeah.
But all these guys had been on all the tree protests. They were really like ground level. You know, they knew their stuff.
Sure.
So I was like a little baby, like, oh my God, they're so exciting. They're so amazing, you know. And most of them were also singers, musicians, artists, painters, makers. So it was just, it really was a wonderful time. It was a really heady time.
Yeah.
So through getting involved with them, I then got involved with other people in the festival scene, people putting on the synergy parties, people involved in spirituality and meditation. So really just started to make content. And being a poet, you can kind of always do your thing, and people always want a couple of poems.
Yeah.
So you get to meet so many people, and then people ask you to come places. So, you know, I've just been on this kind of wild ride of meeting people, being invited to places, getting into new things. And I suppose I did that for 3 or 4 years and noticed that nobody who had kind of saved me in the park had become a someone again. And from being a, you know, thinking that I was the man in the advertising industry, I now thought I was the man as a poet. And my ego kind of started to spoil things.
Yeah.
And luckily I was, you know, that was shown to me. And I kind of wanted to retire, I realized that the same thing had happened again.
Yeah.
And that was very disillusioning this time around. You know, I thought it was, I'm spiritual, and now I'm an activist, and now I'm liberal, and now I'm counterculture.
Now you've got a whole lot of new tags.
A whole new tags and new identities. And so that was quite a shock. And fortunately, a friend of mine, I wanted to write a book called Confessions of a Narcissist. Mm. And one day I still might do it. But my friend sponsored me to take a trip to India for 7 months. Never traveled before. Mm. To sort of, you know, travel broadens the mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And to write my book. And the plan was I'd actually stop using the name Paradox and I'd reclaimed my middle name, which is Chris.
Yeah.
And I was going to go to India, not be a poet,
yeah.
just be a person again,
yeah.
drop that identity and just travel around. And I got to India and everywhere I went, people said, oh, Paradox, Paradox, will you put on a show? Paradox, Paradox. So it was a strange thing because I couldn't drop the identity. So I had then it was like, okay, I can't just drop it. I've just got to learn not to be identified with it, as it were. Yeah. I've got to find a way to balance this performer persona.
Hmm.
And I did some meditation courses and some awareness courses. Again, met lots of beautiful people, had lots of heart and mind opening experiences. One of which was a self-inquiry course, a very powerful self-inquiry course. Which called the 12 Inquiries.
Okay.
Which is based on, very much based, well, it's not based on, but it's very similar to the techniques in Advaita Vedanta and Dzogchen, where you ask yourself the question, who am I? You know, it's all about that identity thing. And that's one of those questions, if you go through the process of asking it and you peel off the onion skins, you find nothing.
Yeah.
And although that's a wonderfully liberating experience, it also is one that can be quite disorienting. And this particular system focused on the fact that everything we believe and tell ourselves, all our interpretations of our perceptions are stories.
Yeah, they're formed, they're just,
yeah, they're stories. We believe them to be the truth, but they're actually stories. Yeah. And at the center of this course was that it's all stories.
Yeah.
And who is the one who is aware of the stories? That's the one you need to be with, which is obviously makes sense. Yet at the same time, we've survived on these stories for, you know, for 40 years.
Yeah.
So to let go of them, it's quite difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that it's normally done is that you become part of that community.
Yeah.
And the community supports you
yeah.
in making the transition
right.
from living by stories to living by awareness. I'm not very good at joining what, to me, is a cult-like organization.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I've always been very independent in that way. And although it's a lovely organization, there were certain aspects that I felt uncomfortable with, so I went off on my own.
Yeah.
And because I went on my own, I ended up having what you might call a nervous breakdown. And so I came back to the UK and was attempting to pick up where I left off, but was unable to. And I found myself giving a talk at the Big Green Gathering.
Okay.
And the talk was supposed to be on an integration of non-dual philosophy and Ken Wilber's evolution of consciousness. I mean, how pretentious was that? But as I stood there and I started to give the talk, I just realized, oh my God, this is all stories. This is other people's knowledge and I'm just regurgitating it and it's all meaningless to me. And I literally pretty much collapsed and couldn't give the talk. And from that point onwards, I was in a pretty bit of a state. So that led to the next stage of my journey, which was in North America.
Okay. Can I just
yes.
can I just stop you? Because you've given us a sort of fairly profound view of your experiences in India, but you've also got a great poem, which is of the sort of perhaps the lighter side of that. And I was wondering if you might be prepared to do your... that Indian...
Oh, go on then.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, yeah, this is definitely the lighter side of it. And yeah, I think anybody who's been to India will recognise some of the things. If you haven't been into India, I think what you what would be important to know is that obviously a lot of... at the time, I was a fully paid-up member of the hippie family.
Yeah.
And hippies travelling in India are just... There's so many wonderful clichés about that. I thought I'd write a poem about it. And I wanted to make it paradoxical, so I set it to the theme tune of James Bond. And as I say, if you haven't been, a few things you need to know is that spirituality and yoga are big business. Indians love, in restaurants, they love to put sugar in everything. If you ask for a glass of orange juice, they'll put sugar in it. So you have to be really careful about that. It's incredibly cheap to live there. Indians don't feel self-conscious about staring at you, just staring at you. And yeah, I think the rest should make sense. So this is called Hippie Traveller. India, Hippie traveler, India, hippie traveler. Sun salutation, sun salutation, sun salutation, sun salutation, Ashtanga yoga asana. Om Karananda Ashram Anashkam Pranayam Pranayam. Can't follow a guru. Om Karananda Ashram Anashkam Pranayam Pranayam. Can't follow a guru. Dana Vipassana Dana Vipassana Dana Vipassana Dana Vipassana. 10 day sit. I'm sick of it. I'm going to Goa. India. Hippie traveler. India, hippie traveler. Chillin' with a baba, puffin', chillin' with a baba, puffin', chillin' with a baba, puffin', chillin' with a baba. Om Namah Shivaya. Masala chai, no sugar, no sugar, ginger, lemon, honey. I'll put in the honey. Masala chai, no sugar, no sugar, ginger, lemon, honey. I'll put in the honey. No shit, the server's down, no shit, the server's down, no shit, the server's down, no shit, the server's down. I got the squids, I'm sick of it, I'm going to Goa. India, hippie traveler. India, hippie traveler. So many pretty girls, God, there's just so many pretty girls, God, there's just so many pretty girls, God, there's just so many pretty girls, but some have really hairy legs. Allah, Vishnu and Krishna and Brahma, Parvati and Shakti, Ramana Maharshi. Allah, Vishnu and Brahma and Krishna, Parvati and Shakti, Ramana Maharshi. So many deities, so many devotees, so many deities, so many devotees. It's big business, I'm sick of it, I'm going to Goa. India, hippie traveler. India, hippie traveler. Sitar on the tabla, learning sitar on the tabla, learning sitar on the tabla, learning sitar on the tabla. A panchakarma enema. Why don't you take a picture? Stop staring, it'll last longer. These bloody mosquitoes. Why don't you take a picture? Stop staring, it'll last longer. These bloody mosquitoes. I don't need a tourist map. I don't want a taxi cab. I can't use your water tap. No, I'm not from Africa. You're taking the piss. I'm sick of it. I'm going to Goa. India, hippie traveler. India, hippie traveler. Himalaya, 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 Himalaya. It's bloody freezing, where's my socks? I've never been so happy, sweet lassie, only 20 rupees. It's bloody amazing. I've never been so happy, sweet lassie, only 20 rupees, it's bloody amazing. I could bum around forever, bum around forever, bum around forever, bum around forever. This is it, it's a perfect fit. I'm coming back in October.
Excellent. I love that when I first saw you do that, which was for one of the gigs we were doing, the
The Voices for Benefit Culture.
Voices for Change, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. That was excellent.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, so you're saying that you're after India, you were heading off to South America, or
First of all, to California.
California.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, that whole thing, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah.
I always planned to go, but I was trying to escape this kind of madness, really, that was madness and depression that was overtaking me. And I thought, well, maybe California. I'll draw my friends out there. We all had an opportunity to go to some festivals and do some work.
Yeah.
And I did that, but wherever you go, there you are. And that didn't really help.
No.
And then friends told me about a rainbow gathering.
okay.
that was being put on in Mexico and Veracruz. And I'd never been to a rainbow. And
what is a rainbow?
It's basically a gathering of anything from a couple of hundred to 10,000, 20,000 people, some of the American ones.
Wow.
Been going since the 60s, and it was very much a hippie invention.
Right.
And the idea was to create a temporary autonomous zone on the land, off the grid, with a non-hierarchical structure where people took it upon themselves to organise things like firewood, water, cooking, all of the essentials.
Yeah.
And that would all be done communally. And then within that would create a space for people to explore their creative pursuits and their inner life.
Right.
And that's the plan anyway.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, that kind of free space attracts to it all sorts of energies.
Yeah.
From right across the spectrum.
Yeah.
So, you know, at one end of the spectrum, you've got some really beautiful, high vibrational, incredible people. Some really amazing, practical people that can build a treehouse with their eyes closed and their arms tied behind their back. Mm. And at the other end of the scale, you've got absolute nutters who are literally, should really be seeking professional help.
Yeah.
And in fact are and have escaped to the rainbow without their tablets.
Yeah.
And it can get quite wild. And we actually had a girl that was certifiable at the rainbow who... was incredible. I mean, she was a kind of manic depressive, so she'd have these amazing insights and people would be sitting around her feet and the next thing she'd be pooing in her hand and throwing it at people, literally. And so that was quite a trippy. But I managed to end up at the Rainbow Gathering, and I'm a city boy and not particularly practical. And for me, it was like, okay, I really need to learn to make things and work in nature. And I loved it.
Mm.
You know, I was chopping wood. Mm. I was going up to the source of the river and sorting out the water and serving food at the campfire. And it was brilliant. It really was.
Yeah.
And it really saved me in many ways. You know,
the
Zen masters talk about chopping wood and carrying water.
Yeah.
And it really, that getting out of my head and getting into...
Mm.
You know, the direct experience of what was facing me was exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, I suppose the most profound thing about the rainbow is that it's an unconditionally accepting environment.
Right.
So you're really accepted for who you are.
Yeah.
And that kind of that foundation of acceptance was really powerful, really heart opening.
Yeah.
So that was really amazing. Mm. And again, I met some more amazing people, one of whom was a guy who'd been running a horse caravan.
Oh, okay.
And he'd been taking a team of horses up from Argentina, where he's from, through South America into Central America. And he'd been doing it for 10 years.
Wow.
And what he would do is he'd stop at the various rainbow gatherings that he would encounter. And he would recruit a team of acrobats and singers and musicians to join him in a kind of traveling circus. A horse caravan circus.
Yeah.
And they're called... Nomads United.
Okay.
And you can find them on the web.
Okay.
And people fly in, and this is people from all over the world.
Yeah.
People fly down to join the horse caravan.
Wow.
And horses are dirt cheap in Mexico. I mean, I'm like £400 or like £300 for a beautiful horse.
Mm.
And I was lucky, he gave me a horse. I've never ridden in my life. And, you know, he taught me to ride cowboy style. Literally, you know, the first day I was rounding up horse, first day I'd ever ridden, I was chasing after horses, rounding them up.
Wow.
And fell off a couple of times, but it's totally true. If you fall off and you're okay, a certain level of fear goes away.
Yeah.
And you get straight back on and it's kind of okay. I think it's the easiest way to learn. So about 30 of us, 30 horses, started traveling around Veracruz, going from little Mexican village to Mexican village, finding a place to sort of pasture the horses. And we'd build a camp and stay there a few days.
Mm.
And then we'd arrange with the locals to put on a show in their town square, because they've all got town squares. Every town looked exactly the same.
Brilliant.
And we would put on a show with them for them and pass around a magic hat.
Yeah.
And that's how we supported ourselves.
Wow.
And a few of the people on the caravan were eco-builders. So they would build these kind of these wood burners and various things, showing the people how maybe they could be more sustainable in their own lives.
Yeah.
And that was just an amazing adventure. And it came to an end after 3 months, where we arrived in a village after a long day's ride, and we took the horses into a river to wash them.
Mm.
And this particular river had a cliff behind it.
Right.
And the local kids had come out to, I mean, most of them never seen a gringo live,
yeah.
especially riding horseback on horseback and dressed in rainbow colours, you know, all sorts of colours. They were just, they couldn't believe it. They came out, so they would be dancing around and showing off the kids, and they'd be, it was obviously their local diving and jumping place.
Yeah.
It was about 10 metres up and they'd be jumping in. And I just had that feeling, which I'm sure your listeners, some of your listeners would have had before, where I was literally absolutely compelled to go and join them. There was no choice whatsoever. Yeah. I call it my soul telling me to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was actually the same thing that made me move into the park. It was the same sense.
Right, right.
However crazy it looks, this is something I have to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I swam across, climbed up, and I stood right next to where they were jumping, and I said, it's okay to jump here. And they're like, see. And I jumped, and where I landed out of the riverbed, a rock was sticking up, a sharp rock, and I hit it with my heel. And as we say in South London, mash up my foot there. pretty badly, and got gangrene, and had a real adventure in Mexico. I didn't have holiday insurance.
No.
And three of the girls that were with me, I mean, we were in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And the first thing they did was take me to the closest thing to a doctor, which was a vet. Because my heel was literally fountaining blood.
Wow.
So the big thing for everyone was, we've got to get it stitched, the wound stitched, which makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's actually twitching now. My phantom heel is twitching, talking about it to you. I don't often feel it, but actually reliving the experience, I'm really feeling it. That's trippy. but anyway, they took me to the vet, and the vet isn't used to human patients. That was obvious, because he was jabbing away with the local anaesthetic, and it was agony. And the local didn't work anyway, but he stitched me up, and they took me back to the campsite. And even though it was obviously really bad, all I could think of is, damn, I won't be able to ride for a week or so. I mean, that's all I was thinking. And everyone gave me all the painkillers they had. And I sat round the food circle, that evening's food circle, and, you know, just kind of thought, oh, I've had an accident. Wasn't really thinking about it in really major terms. Went to sleep, or didn't go to sleep, went to bed. And just the pain just got worse and worse and worse. Mm. And in the morning, I said, oh, you've got to take me to the hospital.
Mm.
I don't know how, I still to this day don't know how they got an ambulance, but the guy who ran the caravan, a guy called Kareem, rode off on his white horse and an hour later came back with an ambulance. This is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I still don't know how he did it. And the three girls, Pachan, Megan and Sula, Megan and Pachan particularly spoke very good Spanish, said, we're going to take him. Took me to Veracruz, a 3-hour agonizing journey. When I got there, the doctor immediately was, he's got gangrene, we're going to amputate, because they get about one case a week.
Right, right.
And they just immediately amputate.
Yeah.
Because most it's farmers and things like that, and they can't afford any treatment. Yeah. But the girls were like, you can't amputate. So they begged them to do what they could to save my leg. Mm. And the doctor was like, well, all we can do is try and scrape the gangrene out, but that means butchering his leg. And they said, well, you've got to do that. So they kind of cut two big gouges out of my leg to try and save it. It looked like a shark bite victim. It was quite ugly, which still didn't kill the gangrene.
Right.
But the girls have discovered this treatment called hyperbaric oxygen therapy. It's actually what all the footballers use when they're trying to speed up their healing.
Oh, okay.
You go in a pressurized container and you breathe pure oxygen.
Wow.
And getting oxygen to your cells will cure many, many things.
Right.
Including gangrene, which is anaerobic bacteria.
Okay.
So I found that treatment, and that actually did kill the gangrene. So all the while that was going on, the girls were sending an email out to my email list, to my friends in England and around the world, saying, look, he's had this accident, he's got no holiday insurance, and if anybody can send some money to help, it would be appreciated, because they were paying for everything.
Mm.
And through that effort, it kind of went viral.
Mm.
And people started passing the message on, and I found out, I started getting messages of support from people. People were putting on gigs to raise money, fundraising gigs. People were doing meditation circles, prayer circles, chanting circles, you name it, people were doing it.
Mm.
And they managed to raise £8,500, which paid for all of my treatment and got me flown back to the UK.
Wow.
And, you know, the girls saved my life, basically.
Yeah.
And Megan, Pachan and Sula.
Yeah.
And thanks.
A shout out to them.
Yeah, big shout out to them. And I got back to the UK, and the doctors looked at my leg, and this is the top doctors in Charing Cross Hospital.
Right, right.
And they looked at it and they said, well, we could reconstruct, but you wouldn't be able to walk for a year. You'd probably get infections. you'd have very ugly scars and you'd probably have pain for the rest of your life. And I was like, oh, really? Okay, cut it off then.
Mm.
And they said that we probably think that's the right decision.
Yeah, yeah.
So I spent 5 minutes saying goodbye to my foot and saying thank you very much for carrying me around all these years. You've been an amazing foot, and kind of had my kind of grief period there. And they send a doctor to you to talk to you about what your function will be after the amputation, below the knee, which is the easiest one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I asked her, I said, look, will I be able to dance? Will I be able to walk in nature? Will I be able to ride a bike? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, I can live with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had such a profound healing with my mum and my sons and my brother and my dad, just my whole family. You know, near-death experiences show you what's really important.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And all of the love and support I'd received from all my friends and the love and support I saw from my family, just, I think you mentioned a different me.
Yeah.
That was mainly the reason. Yeah. Yeah. And so everything that happened with the leg and the journey, my view on it, actually ever since it's happened, is that, okay, this was always part of my destiny.
Mm.
This is always meant to happen. I feel I've given it a meaning. I know why it happened and I've accepted it.
Mm.
And if I'm really, really honest, I'm a much happier and more at peace person than I was before. So I can't really regret it.
No.
I don't really regret it, and I actually wouldn't change it for the world. And then people often say I'd give my right arm for that. And I said, well, I gave my right leg for it instead. So, yeah. So it was a bit of a journey, but worst thing that ever happened to me and best thing that ever happened to me at the same time.
Yeah, they often are, aren't they?
They aren't, they, aren't they?
So we were going to take a little bit of... That was an amazing story.
Yeah, do go on.
No. It's great. I was just looking at our progress. Should we take a little musical break?
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah,
great idea. Let's have some music.
Yeah.
What are we going to have, Ken? DJ Ken?
Well, I was thinking that track, Hope, that you picked out.
Lovely.
Because, you know, it's a, you know... The sentiment, I think, goes with your story.
Yeah, in the darkest, you know, the darkest hour comes before the dawn, and you know, it springs eternal for a reason.
Excellent. Let's check that out.
Therein lies the roots, reaching for the stream. All I wanna do. Keep on reaching through, keep on reaching through to the river wide and strong. It won't take long. We can all go together if we just hold on. The new generation and a brand new age. I wanna fall like a rain. Burning pages rise from the ashes like a phoenix sun, learning to flow, searching for love. You know that I can't get enough. Get enough of that hope. And hope, yeah.
can't get enough.
A nice track and nice sentiments of about hope for the future. And I know you're working on a little project that might bring us a brighter future. But I think the best way to introduce that particular project would be your poem, The Matrix, which I think the listeners will really enjoy. I do too.
Thanks, Ken. Well, according to the World Bank, just 227 families own 47% of the world's wealth. And here's a poem about that. Wake up, Neo. The Matrix has you. You just have to see through the illusion, or you'll rue your delusion. In your confusion, you've been deluded into living in a prison of your own choosing. Do you find it amusing being fed doo-doo by the nightly news, made to crave Gucci shoes while ignoring the real issues, the extraordinarily disproportionate concentration of wealth in the hands of a few? Two twos, you want to cruise the new venues and have a few brews, while the third world sings the blues and reptiles abuse humans, over 1,000 children starving to death every hour for the want of some food. Pardon me for being rude, but while you choose to snooze, our rulers amuse themselves, puppeteering human conflict and directing the daily drama, turning you into a fallacious farmer, sowing unconsciousness and expecting to reap good karma. You think the Dalai Lama can't see farther than that? It's time to clean up your act. Wake up, Neo. The Matrix has you. Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is all around you. It confounds you and astounds you. Its evil genius is bound to arouse the sound of women crying and babies dying. So pay close attention, because I ain't lying. Neo, I'm counting on you. And the countdown started. Rotted. You catch on fast, kid. It seems you get my meaning. It seems you're feeling me, because I'm appealing to the divine in you, the sublime spark of light in you, shining through every single sinew within you, the part of you that really wants to take the red pill and not the blue. So, Neo, choose. Remember, I only offer you the truth, and we both know the truth can hurt, and worse still, you can't go back to your sleepwalking slumber, your imaginary life 6 foot under. Because once you're in Wonderland, no man can put asunder. So, Neo, time to be a hero. And there goes the red pill. You chose wisely, bro, so don't worry if the room starts spinning. That's just the beginning. The red pill disrupts your input-output carrier signals, and we found that confusion often abounds around about the time you hit ground zero. So hold tight, Neo. Here we go. Well, hello. Welcome to the real world, Neo. Ah, yes, your eyes hurt because you've never used them before, and your throat's sore because you've been forced to snore for 20 years or more. But you're awake now, my son, and there's much work to be done. Because, Neo, you're the one. No, you won't need a gun. Forget dodging bullets, I'm telling you. When you're ready, you won't have to. Now, the first thing we have to do is to clue you into the coup, because Jesus Christ Almighty God, have you been lied to? I did try to warn you, and now it's slowly dawning on you that the Matrix ensures the enslavement of the many by the few. It's nothing new. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. You don't think that's a coincidence, do you? That's the Matrix for you. Stare it right in the face and still you ignore it. Here in the real world's where I first saw it. I abhor it. What is it they call it? Free market economics. There ought to be a law against it. It's bullshit. The bastard brain lend it to our governments and charge us a usury. It's an unusually cunning plan, this money for old rope. Bankers getting richer while whole countries go broke. Entire populations held in a chokehold of poverty, reduced to criminality, getting used to rat race banality and paying taxes. So governments can pay back this axis of evil through their tactical patsies. The Federal Reserve Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of France, the Bank of Germany, the Bank of International Settlements, the IMF and the World Bank, see? All privately controlled companies, the directors of which are so rich they're richer than most countries and make Bill Gates look like a country bumpkin. You see, for some, money does grow on trees. And you've been convinced otherwise with surprising ease. You've been brought to your knees, like these people here. Bleeding to death for the want of proper health care and struggling to survive on welfare. We want to get them the hell out of there before what's happening in Greece happens everywhere. And here's the plan. We're using poetry to tell every man, woman and child across the land that our destiny is in our own hands. And all we have to do is take a stand. And here's how. Stop paying for credit. Stop paying the banker's tax. Use interest-free credit schemes instead. Buy all your consumer durable second hand. Buy everything else from markets, family businesses and charity shops only. Stop watching television news and stop reading newspapers too. And if you work for a publicly quoted company, leave your job immediately. And finally, demand that the bankers give back the wealth they've robbed from humanity. Too much to ask of you? Too much for you to do? Go back to sleep then. The Matrix has you.
Excellent, excellent. Says it all, but yeah, does it
in simplified form?
It does, and actually, it is really simple. What's going on with the banking system? Mm-hmm. And I guess
we almost too simple.
Yeah, it is nearly too simple. I've talked to people about where do they think money comes from. And they think the government creates money.
Yeah. People, it's too simple because the idea that 97% of our money supply is created by private corporations from which they profit from by charging interest on it, it's like there's no way that could be the way it is.
And the idea that money doesn't exist until you borrow it.
Right. So it's based on debt, and this is the key thing. So. Yeah. The evidence is out there, the fact that all of the world's so-called wealthiest nations are hundreds of billions of dollars in debt.
Yeah.
In all of the Western nations, the population themselves are even more in debt. Mm. And the whole business world is based on credit. It's based on debt, business borrowing capital.
Yeah.
If that debt was paid off, there would be no money. Mm. So our money supply relies on debt.
Yeah.
And that's the insanity of it.
Yeah.
The debt can only ever go up, it can never be repaid, and the real sort of fundamental thing that isn't often talked about, even when you talk about money reform, is the greatest tax, which is inflation, because we have to keep borrowing more money to stop the system collapsing.
Yeah.
And when you keep feeding more money than is necessary for the economy to run, like for the production,
yeah.
for trade,
yeah.
that creates inflation.
Yeah.
The more money there is, without more money to things to be spent on, the weaker the currency.
Yeah.
So when you consider that over the last 100 years, the American dollar, for example, is now at 4% of its value of 100 years ago.
Yeah.
That's the greater than all of the other taxes, income tax. It's the hidden tax.
Yeah.
And that really is how basically the purchasing power of our money is just being wiped out.
Mm.
And that more than anything else, apart from the fact that this so-called boom and bust cycle of the economy is actually something that's engineered and created, is how the wealth is consolidated in the hands of a few. And, you know, that old saying about the middle class, it's starting to affect the middle class. The numbers of mortgages and repossessions, the number of businesses that go out of business obviously is increasing.
Mm.
But I suppose the idea that we will only have two classes ultimately, the oligarchy and the rest of us, is something that I think people need to wake up to, because that's the inevitable way that the system is driving things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm aware that we don't have enough time to fully explore this. So, I've seen a couple of videos on the internet. Mm. One is Money as Debt.
Money as Debt's brilliant.
It's a fantastic and
cartoon,
easy,
simple.
Yeah, really easy to understand. Mm. It's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
It's really shocking how corporations create our money.
Mm.
I think that's a great one.
That's
and
there's
a party that you
yes.
that you. Subscribe to too. What's
That's
that
right.
called?
It's called the Money Reform Party.
Yeah,
and it's officially registered as a political party, although it doesn't ever imagine it will get into power.
No,
but what it hopes to do is by educating enough people, get itself literally the issue of money reform onto one of the major the parties panels.
Sure.
And right now, there's something called the Proposed Reform Bank of England Act.
Right,
and those two things together, as far as I know, are the most cogent, lucid, practical, you know, without making too much of a drama about very straightforward attempts to address the issue.
Yeah,
and for anybody who really wants to understand it, forgetting the kind of conspiracy side, how does the system work, and what is wrong with that?
Yeah,
if you just want to understand that, and that's what everyone really needs to understand.
Yeah,
the moneyreformparty.com or .co.uk.
Because the whole, you know, we've just had the emergency budget and all, and it just somehow that we're being talked to in terms of how anybody might understand money. You know, like this borrowing, spending more money than you have, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they talk to us in those terms, but actually the backdrop to the crisis has nothing to do with the kind of system that we think
is happening.
That we think is happening. Yeah. So there, you know, that is just terrible.
It's like a magic show.
It's
misdirection.
Yeah.
That's any magician will tell you just at the moment that he wants you looking there,
yeah.
so he does the thing
yeah.
there. And it occurred to me very recently that the easiest way to simplify how the misdirection works, and the budget was the thing that pointed it out to me, because when they were talking about all these cuts that need to be made, it's actually the matrix itself. The key to the matrix is this idea: there is not enough money.
Yeah.
Money is a creation of man.
Yeah.
And it's only because we have to borrow the money from private corporations that we can say there's not enough money.
Yeah.
If, as everybody imagines, the government created money, the government could create money for anything that was necessary.
Mm.
So for whatever public works, a hospital, a school, a road, all of the things that we need money for, that's what it's there for. That's the government's job, to make sure there's enough money in the economy for what we need.
Yeah.
But we have to borrow the money from banks. That's why there's this idea there's not enough money.
Yeah.
There's as much money as we need. There's always enough. It's a ridiculous idea.
Yeah.
And that's how that kind of false economy works.
Mm.
Based on this idea, there's not enough money. So we have to raise taxes or cut public spending.
Mm.
We don't.
No.
We do because we borrow from banks, but we don't need to borrow from banks.
No.
It's really that simple. It's terrifyingly simple.
It is terrifyingly simple, and I would urge everybody to do a little bit of research themselves, because it is It is a shocker.
And my experience is that, you know, you're never going to believe it if you just hear it from someone else. Really need to find out for yourself. Once you find out for yourself, then it can sink in.
Indeed. And as an environmentalist, I mean, it's key to, you know, the whole, that, you know, it, we can march and we can do all sorts of, you know, make protests, sign petitions and all of the rest. But while we have an ever-growing economy, we will continue to destroy the planet.
Exactly. It's the key to the poverty issue. It's the key to the environmental issue. And in many ways, it's key to the war issue.
Yeah, indeed.
All of these things are driven by this constant need to grow.
Yeah.
So if we can address that, it makes it a lot easier to address all the other things that most of us are concerned about.
Yeah. Well, sadly, we've run out of time. So it's been great to have you on the show. And maybe we'll continue this conversation. We'll find another slot for a money program on Radio Reverb, perhaps.
And do the full thing. Yeah, I haven't said this since I was a kid, but thanks for having me, Ken. Thanks for having me, Uncle Ken.
Thanks for joining us.
And
I'll see you at Butterfield.
Yes, mate. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Nice one. And we'll see you next week. Cheers then. Bye.